Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
I always like these events where we have not just one person, but two people. So it's really great to have that combination. I'm going to first mention our own local person, Erica Krause. She's going to be talking about her most recent book, The Contenders. And then secondly, we also have Heidi Pitlor coming in and talking about her book, The Daylight Marriage. So please help me welcome them into the store and give them a big round of applause.
Thanks, everybody, for coming here. Thanks to the Tattered Cover for having us. It really means a lot to us for you to take time out of this beautiful weather day to, you know, and it's really great for Heidi to be here in Portland.
It does feel like, it feels more like Portland than Portland did yesterday.
Right? Oh my gosh, you were in Portland yesterday.
Yeah.
I'm going to start out. I'm the opening act, and I'm going to read from Contenders. I'm going to start out with the beginning, and I want to start with a quote from Muhammad Ali. "It's not just a job. Grass grows, birds fly, waves pound the sand. I beat people up." Nina Black waited in the alley for a fight. It was taking longer than she had hoped. Conditions weren't ideal. A cool wind blew her hair sideways, and she jumped up and down to stay loose. She always forgot how cold Denver could get on summer nights. The graffiti on the bar's back door was blurry. She couldn't tell if it said courage, bondage, or cabbage. She stopped jumping and squinted. The door cracked open, and the words slid into the dark. A shorn head poked out. "There you went," he said. The man's torso leaned out of the door, and his legs scrambled underneath to keep up, until he stood in front of her. In the light from the street lamp, his hair glinted orange. His souring breath wafted across her cheek. "Were you that woman in there?" he said. "That woman at the bar, staring at me?" Nina pulled her hands from her pockets. He said, "I think you dropped something." The man was tall, thick, like someone who had played football in high school and watched football ever since. A Rorschach birthmark blotted his face. His movements were exaggerated, yet careful. He reminded Nina of every drunken 30-year-old she had ever met. "I said you dropped something," he said. Nina scanned the ground and padded for car keys, money. The man sighed and clutched his own T-shirt in his fist. It bunched and lifted until a crescent of belly gleamed above his belt. "It was my heart," he said. He licked his finger, pressed her bare shoulder, and made a hissing noise with his mouth. "You're hot," he said. Then, "I came out here to puke, but now I don't have to." His fingerprint evaporated from her shoulder. He said, "What are you, Filipino?" "I'm American," she said. "No, but what are you?" His face flashed a frown and went slack again. She said, "My mother was Okinawan. My father was a white guy." "Ching chong," he said. Nina tried to breathe evenly, but instead she hiccuped. Rancid cooking oil dribbled toward a drain hole from the open door of a Japanese restaurant, staining the night air with a scent of bitter, scorched fish. She hiccuped again. "Gesundheit," he said. For a second, his face was fatherly. "Hey!" "What?" she said. "You want to blow me?" She hiccuped again and pounded her chest with a fist. "You're drunk," she said. "Nope," he said. "I'm high in Jesus, been saved and everything." He stared at her like she was a $20 bill he had found in the street. He said, "You what? You wanna?" Nina smelled him, his metallic beer breath, sweat, and the chemical scent of air-conditioned flesh. At some point that night, he had eaten celery. He breathed high in his chest. The canvas of his skin was uneven, with pale jade patches near the veins in his temples. His shoulders strained his jean jacket. He reached for her. She stepped out of the path of his hand. "Hey." A sharpness rose in his voice. The alcohol cleared from his eyes, and the capillaries around his nostrils reddened as he sobered up. An updraft brushed their hair off their foreheads. High in the atmosphere, Nina smelled rain. He said, "Come here, you little bitch," and grabbed her wrist. Nina's other arm whipped around and bit into the side of his neck, edging downward into his carotid artery. His knees buckled and his fingers loosened. Before he could recover, she kicked out his standing leg and slammed her palm into his chest, clotheslining him. His surprised face glided through the air, a freckled moon. He landed on his back with a soft padding sound. Almost without realizing it, Nina had caught his head on her instep a few inches above the concrete. She cradled it on her foot for a second, just to let him know that he had been saved yet again, before sliding it off her shoe to the ground. It was over. She stood above him, panting. Adrenaline zinged across her chest. The man's neck muscles strained under his skin as his lungs pulled hard for oxygen. Nina flipped him onto his belly, bent his arms into chicken wings, and pinned them high behind his back with her knee. Her knuckles were turning pink, his imprint still on her skin. She hiccuped again and played back everything that had happened since her last hiccup. How had she hit him? What came first? Could she have done it better? On his stomach, the man was still sucking air, his face torqued to the side against the pavement. Nina thumped between his shoulder blades a few times to help him get his breath back. His breath rasped against her shoe, and a dab of spittle landed on the toe. Between breaths, he gasped, "This ain't right." Nina shoved his fist higher up, his back, and he grunted. The bar door stayed shut. Her vision was beginning to clear, but the graffiti on the door made even less sense than before. The man's pupils jittered back and forth. "Don't worry," she said. "Nobody's watching." "Let me go," he said. She could tell that he was trying to sound reasonable, but the knee in his back cropped his words. He said, "Cut me a break. I'm only human." "But I'm not," she said. He twisted, trying to see her face. His birthmark was a sapphire shadow. He asked, "Then what are you?" She reached for his wallet. Nina was a thief, technically, although she never defined herself that way. Apart from being negative sounding, it was relative. The way Nina saw it, if you stole a wallet, people called you a thief. If you stole an election, they called you president. Nina instead thought of herself as a kind of pool shark, except she didn't play pool. It wasn't her fault that they underestimated her. Men shouldn't be hitting women anyway. I mean, really, what kind of world was this? She was an enforcement officer, collecting small fines from men who violated the social contract. Every animal steals to live. Nina liked to pay her rent on time. She liked to be fiscally responsible. Nina shoplifted too, but only stuff on sale. Meat bound in butcher paper sunk into a handbag. Filet mignon, fresh tuna, an artichoke, socks, stockings, underwear, olive oil. If she thought she was being watched, she stood in line to pay for a single box of spaghetti and walked out cradling a full purse of supermarket makeup and shellfish. She wondered which other shoppers among her were also harboring hidden oil of Olay and vials of saffron. She suspected a higher incidence of shoplifting for embarrassing things like athlete's foot powder, vaginal itch cream, Beano, or extra small condoms, so she made sure to purchase those things outright if needed in case security cameras were trained in those directions. No, stealing was sponsorship. Fighting was the passion. She never stopped, never tried. During dry spells, she missed it like it was lost legs or a drifting lover. She knew what she loved. Of course, like most careers, it's harder for a woman and easily complicated by standards. Nina had a code. She never hit first. Her teacher Jackson often used to quote an Okinawan proverb, "Karate ni sente nashi," there is no first attack in karate, and Nina took it seriously. Anything after the first strike, she figured, was fair game. Besides the first strike rule, she didn't fight kids, women, the homeless or elderly, gangbangers, and crazy people. For practical reasons, she also avoided drug addicts and her neighbors. Basically, she tried not to fight anyone she wouldn't have sex with. It took work. Nina exercised every day to exhaustion. She dressed trampy, hung out in questionable areas of town, Certain streets, all she needed to do was stand with her back pressed to the wall, knees up, knee up, and someone came along demanding a date or worse. On the same streets the next night, nada. The odds sucked, because she couldn't get around it no matter how hard she tried. People are essentially good, and she wasn't as good as she used to be. It was probably temporary, just a series of dumb mistakes resulting in minor injuries, a dislocated jaw, bruised ribs, shiners. They added up. Last month outside a 7-Eleven in the rain, a biker grabbed her and she punched him in the mouth. His front teeth broke and embedded themselves in her hand. He smiled and blood streamed from his mouth in a silky rope. He hit her and hit her again and didn't stop until she ducked and he broke his fist on the wet wall behind her. She heard the bones crack like small thunder, and still he cocked his fist again, a blinking robot. She ran straight home and lay damp and sweating under the covers until the sun came back up. Men on meth were the worst because they felt no pain, had no morals. She tried to avoid them, but she couldn't always identify them if they bathed. She wore precautionary leather, but still bore scars on her ribs and arms. She had been cut 3 times. 5 times. Her nose was crooked and blunt from breaking. She had fractured 4 ribs and a pinky. Her jaw was permanently askew and clicked when she chewed. When she groped her skull, her fingers found dents and scars she didn't remember getting. Sometimes she wondered if she had ever seriously hurt any of them. Perhaps she should go on medication and take one of those drugs that sound like superheroes, like Effexor, Lexapro, Zoloft versus Celexa. She couldn't go on like this forever, winning, or at least not losing. It was mathematically impossible. She wondered if she'd soon start losing when she should win, and if these shitty times were, in fact, her glory years. Sometimes she opened her desk drawer and counted all the wallets she had taken over the years, folded leather piled one on top of the other, mounting evidence that her number was almost up. Nina had survived over 90 street fights. She knew exactly what she was made of. Her old teacher, Jackson, once said, "The smart thing is never the brave thing." He was 5'6". He grew up on Oahu near the military base. On his way home from winning a cockfight, 4 drunken Marines jumped him. He fought them all off, never once letting go of his chicken. Jackson told Nina that her mother was once assaulted in Okinawa by 2 Americans. One of the men kissed her, his hands at her throat. She bit off his tongue and spat it at him. It's impossible to know what a person is capable of until that moment comes and passes, what or who they will sacrifice. That person doesn't know either. What will you fight for? Thank you. And now Heidi Pittler.
That was great. It's so great to be here. You guys, this is such a great bookstore. I live outside of Boston. We don't have anything like this. I feel like I live in the middle of nowhere, but enjoy it. Buy lots of books here. It's important for the world. Okay, so I'm going to read... First, I have to put on my glasses. I'm going to read 2 short sections from my book. And just to give you a really quick setup, it's about a married couple, and they just had a really big fight. They have the woman's name is Hannah, and the husband's name is Lovell. They have a 15-year-old daughter and an 8-year-old son. And I think that's all you need to know. They've just had a really big fight. She went storming out. He's sitting in the bedroom alone, and the daughter comes in. So this is where I'll pick it up. What is that? Oh, sorry. Someone gave me a card last night. It's nothing exciting. I wish it were. Janine pushed the door open an inch and leaned her face forward. She peered around the room. Her hair sat in a brutalized tangle at the top of her head. "You all done?" she asked. "Yes," he said, unable to face her right now. "Let's get you back to sleep," he managed. If he was able to seem calm and steady, she might believe that he was. "I wasn't sleeping," she said, keeping herself behind the door as he approached. "Of course not. I'm sorry. That was no good." He had learned that the more he tried to explain away their battles to her, the worse they sounded. "Where's Mom?" she asked. Hannah slept in Ethan's room whenever he had trouble sleeping, which was most nights. "Probably in your brother's room." Janine stepped carefully around the door and in front of him. "Is she okay?" she asked. His daughter could be surprisingly maternal toward Hannah. "Your mother's fine," he said automatically. "I'm fine, too," he added, not that she had asked. He followed her to her bedroom. He tucked her in, although she flinched at his touch, and then he sat beside her on her mattress. At last, she closed her eyes. He stayed a moment, looking down at his daughter, the wisps of light hair across her temple. Her lips barely parted as she lay there on her side. She may not have been sleeping. She may have been pretending, but he did not say anything. He was grateful that she allowed this right now, that she was letting him just stay here and look at her. The early days, those first few months of friendship, when all that he knew of Hannah Monroe fit inside a daydream. She had grown up on Martha's Vineyard and now lived alone in one of her parents' two off-island homes, a four-bedroom brownstone on Clarendon, where a tree-sized grandfather clock stood guard just inside the front door. She kept a rosewood box of Burdick's honey caramel truffles on her coffee table at all times. She collected antique glass perfume bottles that were rounded and spiny, swirled with primordial indigo and deep opaque emerald. She was passionate about the Red Sox, but hated the Patriots and football in general. She gave the impression of a swan, regal but fragile, lovely and thoughtful and capable of sudden wildness. She called him one night with a ticket to a game against the Blue Jays the next afternoon. "My friend just backed out. I'd have called you sooner," she began. He immediately accepted, and because she had a car and he did not, they agreed that she would come pick him up before the game. The next afternoon, she arrived at his apartment in Brighton wearing a ski jacket, her neck swaddled in a lumpy, hairy scarf. Her nostrils were pink and inflamed, and she sounded congested. Had he missed it over the phone? He led her inside and offered to make her some tea. "We don't have to leave the second, do we?" he asked. "No," she shrugged, "not just yet." He hung up her jacket while she unraveled her scarf. He filled a mug with water and put it in the microwave. They sat across from each other at the wobbly card table in his kitchen. Down the hall, his roommate Paul labored with his trombone skills, unable to reach the higher notes. Hannah's hair pooled onto her shoulders and ran over her small breasts, down over her stomach, stopping at her waist. She had these light-filled eyes, and a black eyelash clung to the side ridge of her nose. She made considerable attempts to sniff back all that was inside her sinuses. He went to find a box of tissues, and when he returned, he asked, "You sure you're up for a baseball game outside?" "I'll be fine. The season's almost over. We have to go." "Thanks," she said as she reached for the box. She asked, "Have you ever been in love?" Her crazy questions, always non sequiturs, still blindsided him. "I'm not sure. I don't think so," he said. Paul groaned and started again at the beginning of his scale. The microwave beeped and Lovell found a box of Lipton. He set the mug down before Hannah, and she brought it to her mouth for a dainty sip. The table tottered beneath her arm, and she wrapped her fingers around the mug to protect the tea or her lap. He found an empty box of Frosted Flakes with the recycling, folded it into awkward fourths, and jammed it under the shortest table leg. Once he took his seat again, she looked off beyond him. "So what exactly does it feel like?" he said at last. "Oh, you'd know," she said. "That's what they always say, you just know," he said. The trombone grew louder, a whiny, embarrassing little brother in the next room. "I'm here, I'm here, I'm here." "Well, the first night I met him, we slept together," she said. This jerk named Doug Bowen had been her fiancé just a few months ago. She talked about him a lot. "And the next night, too. I probably shouldn't admit that." How to respond? Anyway, Lovell had a chemical oceanography paper due the next day. He should have been finalizing his isotope indicators, proofreading. He had 100 things he should have been doing other than sitting here with this girl. She said, "You've never done with that? You've never done that? Slept with someone right away?" She made one last heartbreaking attempt to breathe through her nose. He had, but he didn't think it was love, nothing like that. "What's the right answer?" he said. "There's no right or wrong," she said. "Well, I guess there was this one girl, and we almost did. We got really close," he said. "But I didn't want to hurt her later on, so I held off. I mean, we both did." "Ah, the right answer anyway," she said. He watched her guide the teabag around the water by its paper tag. He was a gawky, long-limbed PhD candidate from semi-rural Maine. He was allergic to shellfish, and in his rare time, he did little other than monopolize his roommate's Nintendo. She was light years out of his league. Now the wrong answer, she said. Yes, we went ahead and slept together, but I didn't really love her, he said. Tell me more, she said. She, he began. A section of his chest withered. He felt protective of it. No. No, she said. He shook his head. Good for you, she said and nodded. Really, it's none of my business. She finished her tea and drew a deep breath, this time through her mouth. She sat up straighter and looked at him anew, as if only now realizing that he was in the room with her, Lovell, and not someone else. You're a good person, aren't you? She said. I try, he said. She studied his face, side to side, up and down. I could use a good person. I need someone good in my life right now, she said. Good, he said sadly. He had landed on that brotherly side of the spectrum. Oh, she said. Oh, what? He replied. His face was hot. It was too late. Nothing, she said carefully. But she half smiled, embarrassed, maybe hopefully intrigued. Are we ready to go? She asked. I'll just finish this chapter. I wasn't going to. There's just a little more. Now, Lovell checked one more time to see whether both cars were in the driveway. When he saw that they were, he headed downstairs for his laptop and answered some work emails. There would be no point trying to fall asleep after this night. He skimmed the newspaper, considered finding his banjo, which he had not played in a few years. He flipped through some magazines. He eventually made his way back upstairs and into bed. Later, he heard the Mechaner kid on his bike outside and the smack of newspapers landing on driveways, as well as the sound of the milk truck screeching down Winter Street. The compact, joyless, bovine woman, Hannah's term, and made him howl, who left bottles of organic milk on people's porches once a week. In the morning, Hannah remained steely for the brief time that he saw her before he had to leave for work. But she allowed him to give her a quick kiss goodbye, and he hoped this might be a precursor to a truce. His thoughts turned to all that lay ahead of him at his office. The numbers from Pago Pago would screw up his estimates of potential intensity and of tropical cyclones, as well as his data proving that increases in sea surface temperatures had to be associated with spikes in potential intensity. Hurricane Katrina had garnered him and his theory some attention, but there were still plenty of naysayers in the government. Lovell arrived at Mass Environmental, and the day began. So the next part that I'm going to read is from Hannah's point of view, and it's the next morning. So we're going to pick up pretty much where that just left off, if I can find. Here we go. Hannah woke alone in her son's bed. Lovell had made coffee. She could almost taste it, hazelnut, her favorite, as she pulled Ethan's comforter around her shoulders. But as she rose further toward consciousness, she remembered all that had happened last night. Was making coffee enough of an apology? After all that he had done and almost done, his aimless rage, the embarrassing violence like a rotten smell throughout the room, and all that he had said, which was worse than his physical bluster, all that he had verbalized to try to make her smaller, just this piddling thing, hardly worth a listen, her empty days, her lazy disregard for bills and cars and recycling. He was stunted, too male, too myopic to comprehend that the piddling things were in fact those bills and cars and recycling, not her. Or had she given so much of her life to those eviscerating tasks and gotten to be herself just as eviscerating? The line of thinking was old and tired. There was nothing new about women despising their drudgery. There was nothing new about women wanting more. On and on she went like this. Coffee. It was a kid dropping his eyes and mouthing sorry to the ground. Lovell was impossible. Being married to him had become impossible, and this sensation bled into the rest of her life and made her feel as if she had become someone else, someone she hardly knew and did not like. She heard Ethan in the hallway and Janine in the shower and Beethoven on that iPod and speaker she carried from room to room. Hannah wondered whether her daughter had enough people in her life, enough friends. She gravitated toward young children. She was a sought-after babysitter in the neighborhood. Or adults instead of kids her own age. She was her father's daughter. Friendships with her peers came a distant third, in Janine's case, after homework and viola. Being likable was not a priority for her. It was Thursday. Hannah had to work at the flower shop later that morning, and Ethan's orthodontist appointment was in the afternoon. She stretched and unwound the sheet from her body. Janine stood alone in the kitchen at the counter, her back hunched. It drove Hannah crazy, the girl's consistently bad posture. Janine wore her black army pants and a green button-down cardigan draped over an old white t-shirt. Clothes did not interest her. Maybe it was, in fact, her height. Not much fit her. At Janine's age, Hannah had already been tall, too, taller than the other girls in her class. Her mother had always said, "You could easily do commercials, print, or TV. Soon you'll be able to do runway. Say the word and I'll call some old contacts." So clearly her mother used to work with models. I forgot to say that. And Hannah's friends always told her, "I wish I was that tall. Do you know how lucky you are?" Janine called commercials the tools of a sexist corporate culture, thanks to a new media literacy class at her school. Hannah's response was, "Well, yes, doesn't everyone already know that?" Janine slouched at the table and glanced over her at her. "You okay, Mom?" "I'm fine," Hannah said, and shuddered to think of her listening to Lovell crash around last night like a big dumb bear caught inside the house. "You look nice today," Hannah tried. Everyone wanted to hear that, didn't they? Janine shrugged and reached for a mug of coffee on the table. "You shouldn't drink coffee," Hannah said. "You're too young." "It'll stunt my growth, right?" "I'd be fine with that," Janine said. "Tall can be pretty. You're pretty, you know," Hannah tried. She looked around the pantry for a box of bran flakes and brought the cereal and a bowl to the table. Janine pulled a strand of long, limp hair toward her mouth. She had this new habit of chewing the hair that hung beside her face, and the ends had gotten matted and wet. Hannah said, "Sweetie, don't suck on your hair." Janine reached for her coffee. Her body was lanky, but at the same time chubby, stretched here and compressed there. She had not taken well to adolescence. Well, then again, who did? Well, Hannah herself, of course. But maybe to be happy at 14 was to be happy too soon, to use up something that was, in the end, finite. At least Ethan had a few more years before the hormones flooded in. Of course, these years would pass in a moment. His 9th birthday was approaching, and she wanted to do something that he would always remember before he, too, turned sullen and sulky. Decorate the house like a spaceship, ask all his friends to dress as aliens or something. Lovell had laughed at the idea. "Seems a little much," he'd said. Hannah stepped behind Janine and kissed the top of her damp head. "Being tall is a good thing. Someday you'll see," she continued. "Coffee isn't good for you." "You drink it," Janine said. She opened the social studies textbook beside her placemat. Lovell blazed into the kitchen and accidentally knocked a banana off the counter. He leaned down to peck Hannah goodbye. He said he was late for a meeting. The kitchen was never clean. He always dropped things and left messes throughout the house. She watched him searching for his keys, but looked away before he could see her. What if he had gone ahead and hit her last night? But then he would have become someone else, someone at least formidable, a significant threat, a legitimate problem. She no longer loved him. She may never have loved him. She poured cereal into a bowl and asked Janine, "Are you going to the library later to work on that civil rights paper?" Janine turned to Paige. "Hello," she said. "I'll go after school," Janine said. "What time should I pick you up?" Hannah asked. Janine stared at the words before her. "What time?" Hannah repeated. "Shit, I don't know. 4, Janine said. "Language," Hannah said. 4 o'clock on the front steps. Don't be late. Ethan has the orthodontist at 4:30. Hannah dug her spoon into the bowl and tried to finish the cereal before the flakes wilted in the milk. Janine left her mug on the table and slid her books into her backpack. She twisted her hair into a frayed ponytail. "Bye," she said, and she ran outside to her bus stop. Hannah looked over at the mug she had left, the brown droplets halfway down the side. Ethan remained upstairs in his room. "Eth, you ready?" she called up to him. "We need to go." She waited for an answer. "Eth, come on, let's get going," she said. But so what if he missed a day of school? So what if he lounged around the house? What if they all abandoned their duties and did what they wanted today? Watch TV, ate sugary cereal, read comic books. Ethan would ride his unicycle around the driveway. Janine would practice viola. Lovell would set up his computer and maps all over the kitchen table. Or he would putter around the house or up on the roof, tending to the solar panels. And Hannah, if she could do anything she wanted today, anything at all, she didn't know. She had no idea. Thank you.
That was awesome.
Oh, thank you. So was yours.
And I know especially how awesome it is because I've read the book, which you will do soon. Now's the portion of the evening when I get to pester Heidi with questions. And then we will open up to you guys' questions. So
three or four.
Yeah, that sounds great.
So I don't know if you know this about Heidi, but she edits since 2007, right?
Yes.
Is the series editor for the Best American Short Stories, which many of us hope to someday. Anyway. Just kidding. No pressure at all on stage in Denver. It's a very, for those of you who don't know the series, it is literally the best short stories of the year. It's an amazing honor to be in it, and to judge it, you have to read 3,000?
I read a crazy, insane amount. Yeah, about 3,000 a year.
3,000 a year. But you write novels.
I know.
Stories. So why don't you write stories, and why, or are you sick of them, or what's going on?
Yeah, it's kind of like, stories are my day job, and novels are kind of my around the sides and coming out the gills job. I think none of us really wants to do, on the side what we do during the day. And although it probably seems like there's not a huge difference between novels and stories, there, to my mind, there is. And it helps separate one thing from the other a little bit. Mm-hmm. I just like the commitment of a novel. I like the feeling of the room and the elbow room and the all the unknowns, I guess. I love that feeling of you're going on this big adventure. And I mean, this one was maybe bigger than I wanted it to be. It lasted longer than I wanted it to last. But in general, I think I just like that experience for me. Mm-hmm. So, I kind of started and didn't look back. And maybe someday I'll try stories. Stories are hard to write, I think, and require a completely different mindset. And you've written both. So. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So what's your thought about the matter?
I think they're, it's funny, when I was writing my short stories, I couldn't even think about writing a novel. It's so big, and it's like trying to haul a king-size mattress upstairs that never end, right? when I was writing my novel, again, took way too long for me. Longer than yours.
Really? How long did yours take?
I'm not admitting that. But longer than yours.
Well, then I'm not admitting mine. But
right?
Really? No, it couldn't
keep
be
it secret.
Let's see if we can get each other to...
It's later.
Really?
Over drinks, yeah. Oh, it's pathetically long because I had no idea what I was doing. When I was writing that, I could not write short stories at all. I tried, and they were terrible short stories. In fact, I sent them to people, and they wrote back. This is what I got back. What's wrong with you? Are you okay?
You need new friends or something. That's kind of rude.
These are really good writers. I guess I'm really sucking at this right now. But since I finished this novel, I'm actually working on both at the same time, and it
good
feels
for you.
Perfect because, the novel is always just like this big monster,
it's really ungainly.
And then I can sort of cheat on the novel with the stories. And then, when I'm done with the story, and it's kind of not enough, like the not satisfying sexual experiences you were talking about earlier in your book. Except that was so satisfying.
What?
And then you go back to the novel, which is your marriage, right? So,
I feel like that too, but I feel like the affairs aren't quick enough for me. I mean, there's like they want to be four nights, and I want it to be one night. Right. So when I try a story, it's like a little, we're saying way too much tonight. But I think
this has no bearing on our personal life.
No,
whatsoever.
None. But I do think that stories are hard work, and I think I've tried them. I've kind of dipped a toe, and I've been like, I don't really want to revise this 20 times. It's a story, and it's my own mindset. But I think it's important to differentiate the tasks in your life some way, or else so for me, I need to separate them a little bit.
Right. Let's talk about dark characters, because we both are not a lot of women I found write dark characters, right? It's kind of unusual for a female author to write seriously dark characters, and you and I do. So why don't you talk about that? What draws you to the, is it, does it speak to like a larger philosophy of life, or do you just like the dark?
You know, it's fun. I think I must be dark because I don't see them as all that dark. And even your book, which is dark, once you get over thinking this is a dark, this is a woman who fights, she's just a character. Mm-hmm. To me, this book was, I wanted to write a page turner, and I wanted to write something where there was a lot at stake. So that's sort of where my head was at. I mean, I don't really think of things in terms of dark and light. I mean, mine is a heavy book. Yours is kind of a heavy book too. But I don't think of it in those terms. So it's really hard when readers say, like, why, you know, I've gotten this a few times, why would you write something so intense? And I think, well, if you're going to spend, you know, I'll own it, 8 years for this very slender book. If you're going to spend 8 years on it, a light romp is going to maybe not keep your attention for 8 years, or even 2 years. I think you need to have some really itchy questions that are going to stick with you for a long time if you're going to sit down and commit to a novel. So those, to me, I think probably tend to be darker, but I don't go out and say, what's the kind of creepiest, darkest place I can go to? Do you?
No. In fact, you know, I never think that anything I write is controversial or funny. And people are like, that was funny and controversial. I'm like, oh, crap. I was trying to do something else. But, you know, so it's kind of, I think maybe you just write what you write. But you said something about itchy questions. What were your itchy questions with The Daylight Marriage?
Without giving away too much, I think the connection of our bigger picture of fate, what ends up happening to us, how that connects to smaller decisions we make was the kind of picture for me. And also how destructive on a soul level a bad marriage can be. I was interested in that. I lived in this town when I started writing this where I felt like it was kind of a weird throwback to the 50s. There were a lot of stay-at-home moms and working dads, and it just felt like this eerie place where everyone was living very much on the surface. And it interested me to try and say, well, let's take a couple that's sort of like that and go a little bit deeper and see what might be going on there and push it to its really outer limits. What would happen if these people, you know, behind closed doors let it rip? And then in the aftermath of that, what could happen if X, Y, and, you know, one decision led to another, led to some major shit hitting the fan. So
what does that do to you? I mean, this is going to sound really corny, but what does that do to your soul? I mean, you know, you work on a book for so long, and you know, you're thinking about darker topics and really difficult stuff. What does it take a toll on your life, or are you really able to be like day job, night job? You know,
no. I mean, there were some hard moments, and you know, I did. It was. You're both struggling. You're in the story and you're struggling with the story. So it's a really funky place to be. It's a lot. There were many, many times where I just wanted to put it away and step away. And also the other thing I should say about this story is that 2 weeks before I passed it in, it was a completely different book. So it had scaffolding around it. It had another character. This story that is now there was the backstory. And there was another kind of much more palatable story around it. And my editor very rightly convinced me to get rid of that. But having that scaffolding there all those years, having the nicer, really what was an entryway into this story there allowed me to kind of keep a little bit of distance at times. And then when it was time to let it go, it was terrifying. But I think if you have a good editor, or if you have good readers that will say, you know, The best advice is always follow where the energy is. For this book, if this is a page turner, you don't want to water it down with all this pleasant stuff. You know, let's get to the story at hand. And I felt like I learned a lot in writing this. I learned kind of about pacing and what I hope makes readers want to turn pages. And I think that's an important thing as a writer. I think we get lost a lot in what we want to say, but I think it's important to think about what people get out of the experience of reading too.
Right.
And it's important to keep readers compelled, I think.
Right.
So what about you? I'm sorry to keep bouncing it back to you, but what about your darkness?
my darkness. There is for a lot of the book, actually, I didn't have this one scene that I have in there now. And I felt like I was kind of dancing around and playing at fighting. Because, you know, fighting's really, really dangerous. I mean, don't do it. Okay, just that. Please don't fight each other here. I don't think Tatter Cover has a liability for that. I felt like I was sort of avoiding some of that really dark stuff. So the last scene I wrote is a really harsh scene. It's about midway through the book, and it goes there. You know, goes to that place, and that is that's when I get that, like, what the hell were you thinking question. But yeah. I kind of reach the same moment where it's like, I've got to go there. I've got to actually do this and show what this really can be. And it's a hard scene to write. And actually one interviewer said it made her physically ill, which was, I was like, well, you like the book, but yeah, you know, it's,
that's good. I think that's good though. And I know, it, yeah,
she's like, it made to me give someone a reaction nauseous, and she was maybe a little angry at me.
Yeah.
But, you know, like she was like, why'd you do that to me? And, but it kind of felt like you know, if you're going to really address a topic, you can't just pad around it and make it nice. You have to actually right. look at it. And that's hard.
And, yeah, no, I too. I mean, I'm interested in, and this is going to sound weird, in making people a little uncomfortable and rethinking their lives a little bit. Mm-hmm. I think to, and there are different, you know, reasons to read. There are books where that are like happy vacations. There are books that are fun, and there are books that make you think. And I definitely set out to write one that was not a, you know, feel good story.
Right. No, you want to make people think, and people yeah. don't always think when they're just like, you know, I mean, books aren't about, they're not about, you know, sunshine and rainbows and unicorns, because you
well, there are
so
some
bored.
Back there, by the
that's
way.
That's true. And while I was reading, I was looking, listening to the little ones going, dee, 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 and I'm like, oh no, I hope I'm not at a bad part. But yeah, but that we outgrow it, right? We get bored. We get right. bored with that, and we want some trouble, right?
Right.
People watch Jerry Springer. I mean, it's not, you know, we want to see the pain of life, obviously, and inflict it upon ourselves if we're watching Jerry Springer. So you have a line in your book that really intrigued me about how Hannah, the main character, is thinking that, you know, women are expected to be predictable and expected to be, like, safe in that way. And Hannah is in her life, and then suddenly she's not. And then everything, you know, then it's a SHIT show, right? Everything kind of goes crazy. So do you want to talk about that a little bit? Again,
yeah,
does it speak to a larger philosophy? Or?
You know, it doesn't really, but I do think that when, you know, especially as a mother and a wife or in your job, it's an old thing. We think we've progressed past it, but I don't know that we have. Again, when I lived in this town, I think that, we, you know, in so many ways, we're still behind on the gender front. And women are expected to be predictable in some ways. I think there's great discomfort. I mean, I think everyone's expected to be predictable in a way, but I think that you'll see it if you're standing around with a group of friends in mixed gender company. If someone kind of goes off in a way that, you know, isn't that threatening, people are threatened by it. And I think that really interested me. This was a character who was at her happiest when things were unpredictable. And this is when she starts feeling really nostalgic for her early life. And she's lost some of that. And that's one of the biggest problems in her life, is she knows exactly what's going to happen every day. And I don't think she set out to make that happen. You just kind of slowly slide into that when you have kids and get married and grow up, in a way. But I think it's a hard thing to reckon with for a lot of people. I think that the predictability of adulthood can be a really crushing thing for people. And that was interesting to me to explore in this book, and to explore what happens when she really, really lets go of that and opens herself up to something else.
Right, and the world isn't so accommodating of
right.
unpredictability.
Right.
But you'll find out how later.
Yeah, we're sounding so cagey here.
I know. Suspense. So maybe we could open up
yeah,
questions
that sounds great.
To you guys. Do you have questions?
Go ahead. Yeah. I think it's always good for the when someone tells you what you should do with writing to ignore it. Pretty much always, I would just say. I think that's the best writing advice, is to figure out what it is that you're writing and what it wants to do and what's the best way to do that. So for two protagonists, well, for a while I had three. So that was part of my scaffolding, was I had this third person who had to go, very sadly.
What did they do? Or she?
Well, so she was someone that would be in the future with this family. She was a neighbor that had a lot to do with them, and she was a kind of caretaker type. And she really did have to go. So I was balancing three of them. But for two of them,
I think, you know, it felt really comfortable to me because a novel's a big place. It's a big empty house, and I think it's always interesting to get different perspectives going. And you can say a lot in the space that's between those two. You know, to leave some things unsaid, I think, can create nice drama. And to give the reader a sense that they know more than the characters, I think, is a really nice tool to have. I think it involves a lot of mapping things out and keeping, you know, people swear by Scrivener. I don't know if you know of Scrivener. I know. I'm a big fan of pieces of paper all over the place and like a really messy office. Or also whiteboards are really good. But there's a lot to keep track of. I mean, it logistically can be kind of tough. But this book wasn't so tough because there really is one pretty cohesive story that's going on with a lot of flashing back. But it came in such an irregular way that I didn't even see them as a separate person in some way. I felt like I was writing their marriage and they were kind of here, but my head was here, if that made sense. And they were speaking to me. Writers sound crazy sometimes. This is one of those moments. And they were I was hearing voices and I sat in a room by myself all day for 8 years. It's fine. So I think first of all, don't listen to any of these articles. Write what you want to write and have fun with it. I mean, I think it can really energize your work to have different points of view going at the same time. And if you feel like it's straining, take a break, twist it around some way, work with it. But I think if that's what you feel like it needs to be, by all means, let it flow. Let it be that.
I think also sometimes you need relief. Like,
yeah.
I have a very strong female protagonist, and then I have another point of view character who just gives relief from her. Because if you're in that head for however many pages, you'll throw the book across the room. It's just too much. It's too intense, you know. So it can give you that sort of – and also the perspective of the characters on each other. I think it's wonderful. I mean, Barbara Kingsolver did it, so we all get to now.
Yeah, exactly.
So did William Faulkner, actually. So
I think lots of people have done it. Yeah. So. Anyone else have any questions, concerns? I have a quick question for you. I'm sorry. Can I just ask you this?
Oh, sure.
This is a really obvious question, but are you a fighter? How did you get into the fighting thing?
Yeah, look at me.
Well, no, I think it would be really cool if you were, because it's so unexpected. You just don't.
Right. It's unusual.
Don't bring it on me, but I think it's, it's really interesting.
Well, I've done it for... I started with judo when I lived in Japan. I lived in Japan for 4 years when I was a teenager. And I was the only girl there, and I got killed. And then it sort of was addictive. It's totally masochistic, and I think it's actually the same thing that makes you write a little bit, you know, just getting pummeled. There's a sort of invincibility to it. You know, after a while, you're like, yeah, you can break my nose, but you can't break my mind, or I don't know what it is. But there's like and I always fought men because there just aren't a lot of female fighters. You know, maybe they'll do it for like, a few months, and then they'll realize how stupid it is and leave, because women are generally incredibly intelligent. So, except for this one right here. So I've done it a lot, but always poorly and always, and I've gotten everything broken. I mean, I'm just a mess of scar tissue and donuts now, because it's been, I'm a lot older, so there's the donut factor. But I don't, I've never really reached any kind of high achievement with it. But I've done pretty much like most general styles you can name. I have a fascination with it. And I don't have a fear of it anymore. I used to be really afraid of it. That's another thing. I was really afraid of it. And same with a novel. Writing a novel, I was like, oh my God, I'm terrified of this. So sometimes you just have to do it so you're not scared. And then you actually get interested and you make it your entire life. To the chagrin of your bank account. So I think I've really encouraged any budding writers in this audience. Feel my job is it's done here.
That's good.
Other questions? Yes, Nikki.
What is the donut factor? And maybe you could speak to your autobiographical influences.
Oh, the donut factor is I eat a lot of donuts, so I'm a really, really bad fighter, partly because I suck in general, but but also because I eat too many donuts, and it has turned into a sort of donut situation right here. So Yes, you're right. It protects internal organs such as your stomach and your spleen, whatever spleen is. Autobiographical influences, like, what do you mean? Like how?
Well, I meant for Heidi too.
Oh, because
yours is.
I've talked about mine.
Fighter.
For this book for sure. So one thing is that I wanted to write, again, I said this before, I wanted to write a book that was a page turner and something big happened. So there was that. And so I started this long, long ago, back in the days of when there seemed to be a lot of these beautiful women that went missing and all these stories. Lacey Peterson was in the news. Just before that, Carolyn Bessette Kennedy went missing, but she was all over the news. And I thought, why do we care so much as a culture? But why is it always the same person in the news who goes missing? And then, so probably for a few weeks, I kind of tiptoed around something about just a story, a vague story like that. And then a woman and her baby in my neighborhood were shot and killed by her husband. And the media flooded in. And I became obsessed with this story, and I would drive by the house and watch the news and try and figure out what it turned out. Her husband was a British guy, and he left all kinds of clues. It wasn't a big mystery or anything, but it just got in my head and under my skin, and I couldn't let it go. So, and that's not at all what happens in the book, but that idea of this person as a character who goes missing kind of got under my skin. So I worked on it for a few years, and then someone, and it was always a structure, although there was a third character of the husband and wife going back and forth. And then one day, some well-meaning friend sent me a review of a book and said, "Huh, this looks a little like yours." And it was called Gone Girl. And I went, shit, what is that? But I read it, and it's so very different. There's a similar premise, but there's different tone, there's different everything about it that I felt like it was still okay to continue on. And I think they're different enough that they both can exist in this world. I think if you loved Gone Girl, you might not love this book, or maybe you would, but they hit very different, very different parts of the reader, I think.
It just takes ridiculously long to write a book, and I don't know about you, but the whole time I was writing, I'm like, I hope I don't get scooped.
You do. It's kind of your worst night. Well, then imagine getting scooped by Gone Girl.
Right. But it's a totally, totally, completely different book.
It is. And yeah. And again, it's completely different, but it sort of feels like if maybe that weren't in the room, it would be a little easier. But I'm totally fine with it now. And again, I think it's different enough that – but it did – it got in there enough to kind of throw me off kilter for a while. Yeah.
Because it's a movie.
And then it's – right, a freaking – right, David Fincher movie, which I thought was really good. But And I thought the book was really good. But again, different books – teeny bit of a similarity in premise, but otherwise completely different.
Right.
So
it's kind of yours is kind of like the other side of the story.
Yeah.
You know, if you take away some weird psychosis and.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Right.
Which we all need a little less psychosis in our life.
Yeah.
Jim, you had a question, right?
Well, yeah. So going to your point, I mean, both books sound like page turners from what I'm hearing here.
Yeah, yours
is. And what is that? Because, you know, I read a lot of page turners and they're kind of like, you know, no real introspection. It's like bubblegum, you know?
Yeah.
And then there's the other extreme. And what's the balance? Or is it a balance in that? What makes the page turner in your mind?
That was what I was going for, is something that went deeper and was a page turner. Because I feel like that's rare out there these days. It's hard to find. And I think it's a really interesting cross section to have a mystery that has some psychology and depth to it. And I'm not saying all mysteries are badly written at all, but to have a literary page turner. So what was your question? I just lost it.
What makes it? Page turn.
Yeah. Yeah.
For me, it's the element of surprise. Like, even if the surprise is, not necessarily plot oriented, but if you can surprise the reader on every page, hopefully more than once on a page, then I think they're going to keep going. But you know, there's that problem of tension all the time, and to have tension in a book, they have to care about the characters. So it always goes back to the characters. Like, do you care about the characters? Do you care what's happening? Or if you don't care about the characters, do you care based on a larger idea of like some kind of social justice, or you know, or something like that. You know, I've read books where I hate the characters. Lolita, I mean, for God's sakes, you can't really, you know, oh, Humbert. No one's been like, yeah, that's a swell guy I want to have a beer with, right? Or if you hope they've never said that. But you'd need to find out, like, will there be justice? Will Lolita survive this? You know, even though you sort of find out right in the prologue, but you don't know you do. So, I'm talking too much. But anyway, you know, you need the surprise and the tension, and part of, like, the surprise with something like where you hate the character, for example, is when you find yourself being like, oh my God, that's me. Right. Mm-hmm. So that again adds another piece of tension. I think it's like a million different ways to add that, but I think it always comes back to that. And that question, like, will they, why, you know, should they, how will they, is the key. But, you know, you write incredibly page turning books too. So, you know, what is it for you?
Well, I'm always trying to do that kind of balance, you know what I mean? Where it's sort of like, let's be a little introspective, but not so introspective. I'm trying to be a little humorous, I think sometimes really helps pull it through.
Yeah.
But, you know, I struggle with it too, you know? When am I bogging it down, and when are they turning too many pages at once, I guess, you know, is the thing, you know? So I'm always curious to hear about that.
You know, making your dialogue really work for you is one thing, because dialogue, you know, it's one of those, you know, it really has to move the plot. And you mentioned humor, and I think humor is a big deal. But they're also just like, do nots, you know, don't make them bored. Don't make them tired. Don't, you know, don't make them, this is my pet peeve, don't have them looking at each other. He looked at her, she looked at him, they looked at each other. Who cares? You know, they're like, people look. You know, you're looking at us. We're looking at you. I mean, we're all looking here.
Or the wasted. I always feel like, especially in short stories, I read of, "Hi, how are you? I'm good. How are you?
Oh gosh.
You know, and it's like you
crazy,
just
crazy.
Cut. I mean, you really. My editor that I worked with shaved this right down to the bone in a great way, I thought, and I realized, God, we all write. There's so much fluff around what we write, and I think there's this idea that a novel has to be this, you know, big, grand kind of thing. And I think this book is not. It's very short, and it was really liberating to kind of think it can be all movement. It doesn't have to be. Some books, I mean, the joy really is kind of sitting down and relaxing and floating through it. But for me, at least for this one, I wanted it to be more of a like a fast-moving experience.
Even a reverie, I think, needs to move the story forward. Even if they don't have that reverie, something's not going to happen, right? So I think it's, you know, just always. And I had the same thing. Man, I cut stupid amounts of pages.
Yeah.
The first time I handed it into my editor, it was 150,000 words, and it already shaved off another 100,000 words.
Which is how
words.
Many pages?
It's a double. Basically. That's double the size of a book. So, and it doesn't deserve that. So, I mean, I like the book, but you know, let's be serious. It's War and Peace. It ain't. So, you know, so like you have to, you know, be reasonable about, you know, and that's another thing though. Really know what size your book should be. You know, we all think it should be definitive about life, and you know, but no, like how much of the reader's time are you going to take out of their life, you know, and away from books like Middlemarch, you know, which everyone should probably be reading instead of my book. So go buy Middlemarch, but also buy my book too.
Mine too. Go buy mine too.
Yeah. Right. Well, I was just saying, mine's not as good as Middlemarch, but Heidi's clearly is better than Middlemarch.
No.
So buy that first, then Middlemarch, then my little paperback.
Also,
here.
Best American Short Story as well.
Yes.
What
really
else can we plug?
Good. Good.
Yes. Any other?
You're an editor and a writer. Are those complimentary or antagonistic?
You know, I'm called an editor, but really what I do is read. So I work on this book called Best American Short Stories, and I read like a bajillion stories a year, and I pick 120. I send them to a guest editor, a big, famous, successful writer, who picks 20, and they go in the book. So I'm not actually editing manuscripts. I used to do that, but I haven't for 10 years. So when I was hands-on editing and working with writers, that definitely got into my writing more. And I think I would, there was more cross-pollination. This is more reading and then writing, so it's pretty different. Yeah.
What's your like automatic turn off for a short story? Like you read that and you're immediately down. For you short story writers.
I know. Well, the mistake, you know, like I'm trying to think of page one turnoffs. So much of it's this intuitive nuance kind of thing. But if let me think for a minute. It's trying too hard is a big turnoff. I don't know. You get this really fine radar for someone putting on a pose. And unless that's the point of the story and that's, you know, what the character is supposed to be or the voice is supposed to be kind of that. But the kind of... you know, a very goopy opening with a very labored purple description of landscape is usually not going to make me want to read a ton more.
Right.
But that for every goopy purple description of landscape, there's a long, beautiful, rich description of landscape that I love. So it's hard to sort of say categorically don't do this,
right?
Because I always find writers that do stuff that I hate and I still love them. I think that's been my big challenge for this job is how to get over all my allergies as a reader. I used to hate second person. I used to hate first person present. I used to think, oh, this is so young and, you know, hip. And now it's just, it's there. It's in the air. You can't make rules like that because there's always a good writer writing in second person, first person, goopy landscapes, the alarm clock going off. You know, I kind of feel like, good for you. You know, all the rules that you're not supposed to do, that it was all a dream. I mean, it was, some people can do that. And if you can do that, then, you know, bonus points.
Right.
If you can do the thing you're not supposed to do and make it work, then that I think is great.
I think short stories are a really great barometer for what's happening in fiction.
Oh, yeah.
And you've been doing this since 2007, so you kind of – you have your finger on the pulse. Sorry for the cliche. So don't do that in your writing, obviously. You know, don't write finger
– Or
so,
you can if that's what the character's all about.
Unless they – yeah. Right. So what are you seeing? What's happening?
Well,
what changes?
Not a huge amount of changes. Like, you know, there's more – there's – we've all seen dystopic novels come out, and it's seeping into short fiction a little bit more. And I think the form is maybe not as hospitable as a novel is to dystopia, but not always true. So that's there. Every year I read more and more stories by former soldiers. The Iraq War is still getting bigger and bigger. More people, I think, are coming home and writing about it. A little bit more about the economy, a little bit more about science, more melding of genres, which I think is really exciting. But, you know, there's still the same people that are being ripped off every year. Raymond Carver, Lori Moore, Jhumpa Lahiri. There's like five writers that always get ripped off. Does this mean we should wrap it up?
No.
Yeah. So, that's sort of the general thing. Because I don't have a crazy enough year, I'm publishing a third book. So I have the annual, I have the novel, and then Houghton Mifflin is publishing a book called 100 Years of the Best American Short Stories, and it's coming out in October. Nice. So along with reading 8 bajillion stories a year, I've read all 100 volumes of the thing just to make sure that I'm crazy. And so it was really interesting to see all the trends, you know, through the last century and how the news makes its way into short stories. And one thing that has really changed is this. So it used to be that after a war, nothing would show up in short fiction for 8 to 10 years. There was always there was this gestation period and time needed to digest it. And that seems to have shrunk. And my theory is, which is based on nothing, but is the internet. Mm-hmm. And the fact that now there's instantaneous, writing is so easy. Expression is so easy. We're not a culture anymore that needs to kind of sit on our feelings and make sense of them. We're kind of out there. So I'm seeing a lot, you know, more fiction that's the time has shrunk. Mm-hmm. So, 2 years after Hurricane Katrina, I read a flood of stories. I didn't do that on a whole bunch of stories about that. So it does seem like that time has shrunk a little bit. That is one big change. And also the technology has just, I think, changed the whole landscape. The format of stories has changed. I mean, I get stories that are podcasts, audio stories, online stories. They come to me in the most bizarre formats. It's hard to know what my criteria is sometimes because I'm not sure what's going to land on me from what source.
Or Jennifer Egan's
Yes.
PowerPoint
story. Twitter stories, right, Facebook stories. Yeah. It's really, really hard, let me tell you, to try and, for my job, to try and follow the Twitter fiction out there.
Right.
So I just don't.
You had said you had a question, Derek?
Well, okay, technically I have two, because since you said that you've read all the 100 years, like, how long did that take, first of all?
I know, it's crazy. And that's what I'll blame for why this book took so long. it took about 5 years. Yeah, it was a long, long project. But it was wonderful, too. I mean, it's so great to go back and see how much has changed. And the big, I think, lesson of the day is how much, you know, short fiction tends to be the domain of the privileged white person, and how that's now finally changing. Way too late. But it's diversity is now finally, I think, starting to show up more in short fiction, which is nice. But to go back, it was, I mean, the first 40 years or something, there's so much racism, there's so much sexism in the stories. It was hard to judge, is this a good story if it's completely offensive to me? And a lot of them were. It was a very different world in 1915, 25, 35. So it was a tricky, tricky job.
You're going to meet her?
Yes.
Oh, my God. Cover.
She's going to be one of our other stories. So thinking about your character, Nina, it's like, well, I really don't want to meet this person, but I won't forget her. Right. And then when I was thinking about your characters, Heidi, there's times when I really am truthful with myself. I was part of some of that dynamic, but also I've seen that in other places in my life. Both are so real to me.
Yeah, good.
That's just fascinating.
Oh, good.
8 years and more than 8 years.
9? Is it 10? 12?
I'll tell you.
Oh,
but
exciting.
We need alcohol.
Okay.
And I'll need more alcohol because I've had more years. but I think...
Yeah. Thank you. How do you make them real? How do you... I don't know how else to make them, I guess. I think that, you know... I have always had this question. I always want to ask people, what would you never write? And for me, it would be like superheroes or alien people. You know, I don't know how to write anything else but people's thoughts. And I think that, you know, you take a little from you, a little from this person. I think after you work on it for enough time and play with stuff... You learn to listen to what you're writing, and if it to me, it again comes back to it's really important to me that what I write and what I read be authentic, and I really have a hard time with something that feel with people that are not authentic. So it's the same thing that I want from my fiction, I guess. And so I think I have a good eye for my own poses on the page, which are there as much as any writers have, and for my own bullshit, and to just keep carving it away and highlighting there's a moment, there's a really pretty moment where you're not saying anything and you're avoiding the nastiness that's over there. And if I think to just be really honest with yourself as a writer is the way to get at some of that.
And it's really hard.
Yeah.
I think, you know, for me, I had a hard time understanding this character for a long time. And I just had this, like, German idea, like, a woman who fights. I'm like, I know there are women who do this, probably somewhere, maybe in jail. But you know, there's got to be this person somewhere. And I didn't understand what would make a person, you know, I think it went back again to writing for some ways. In some ways, this is an allegory for me for writing. But like, you know, why would you put yourself in such a position of disadvantage over and over and again? And, you know, what if you're really good, like this, my main character is really good at something that the world has no use for. Again, allegory for writing. Yeah. Just kidding. That is so not true in this world, and that's why I'm going to make a bed for myself right there in the corner of the tattered cover. But, you know, so I need to understand it. I needed to understand what makes someone do that, and it took me forever to understand her. But once I started understanding her, it was like a process of embodiment, and then I'd be, you know, in the grocery store, and I'd be like, oh, God, Nina would hate that. Or someone would say something, I'd be like, oh, my God, how would she respond? She would, you know, it's almost like a friend – that you know so well, and you can predict what they would do. And I think there's a long time. For me, it took me a very, very long time to get to that point of embodiment where I knew her reactions as well as my own, and then I could write about her. So I wish there were a quicker way. I think a lot of it comes just through writing and writing and writing and writing your way in. Thank you, everybody.
Oh, one more. Yeah.
Lumens.
How did you go about writing so much violence? Were there struggles in doing that? So how did you overcome
that? Yeah, so how did I go about writing violence? It was a quandary for me because I hate violence. I hate it, and I've experienced it and despise it. But I love fighting, right? So that doesn't make any sense. So I had to sort of negotiate that. So for a while, I was writing the fighting without violence from her point of view, and then I had to again go to that violent place because that's what fighting is. It's not always that, Like if you've trained a martial art or something, you can be like laughing, you're butt off as you're training with your friends and you're doing these terrible things to each other, but it's really funny and fun, and it's just this other world kind of. But to go to the violent place, I had to do it in layers. So when I was writing the more violent scenes that apparently make people nauseous, I had to, I had to go in, and then I'd be like, okay, enough, I need a shower. And then, and then do another layer, and then another layer, and kind of keep going back. And once it's like building any kind of scaffolding or something, once it's laid, it's laid. So then you can build on that and then build on that. But I had to build up a tolerance for my own stuff that I was doing too. And then I had to go back and say, how can I make this bearable for someone to read? Why would they get through it? Where am I placing it? Are they invested enough at this point, or are they going to throw this book across the room? And have I built up enough callus for the reader? So I had to treat the reader very carefully throughout the book to, toughen them up a little bit to the point so that when I got to those scary places, they would stay with me and in the hopes that there was something that would bear fruit after that. So it's really tricky. I think if there's violence on the first page, you're setting a certain contract with the reader, and the reader who loves violence is going to be like, yeah, but my book is not pro-violence. So I don't want people to walk away with that. I hope they don't. So it was really a series of negotiations, contracts, and agreements that I made up until it got pretty hard. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Thank you, everybody.
Yeah, thank you, you guys. That was great. It was fun.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.